Hello, Stephen. Thank you for joining us on BD and Me's mid-weekend. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you. How was your Christmas and New Year to start with?
How was Christmas and New Year? It was fine. It was okay. I'm struggling because I'm allergic to my flat.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's a pretty sort of unfortunate state of affairs.
And did you spend Christmas and New Year's in your flat?
I wandered the streets like a person.
Well, that's all right then. At least you do.
I would rather live under a bridge like a troll than spend time in my flat. It is miserable. It is like my eyes are streaming, my nose, I'm sneezing constantly. I don't know how to combat this problem. I don't know what it is in the flat that's causing it. But it's a pretty strange and depressing state of affairs. Merry Christmas.
and to you too.
Returning somewhere to perhaps a happier place for you, obviously you started out here on Warwick Uni Radio. How was that for you?
It's strange to be back on it. It was called W963 when I was at the university, and the equipment was fairly ropey, as I remember.
Still is.
It was still all bits of sorts of reel-to-reel tape that we used to have to cut and splice by hand. I think the sort of digital thing was coming in towards the end, and I don't know whether things are different now, but I'm fairly sure no one could hear the show when I did it on a weekly basis. I think you had to stand in one of the union cafes, and that's the only chance you could hear it. It was pretty tough to listen to. I guess it was pre-digital radio and stuff, so it was very. I don't know if we ever had any listeners, but I nevertheless took it very seriously. I used to work hard. I had my little posse of friends, and we used to try and do, you know, a good professional, slick 2-hour show every week. We used it as like a learning curve, you know, to try and kind of hone our skills.
Did you always have a sort of a love for radio, or did it only arise when you came to uni? Did you know about it before, or?
I did have a love for radio. I had dabbled with it when I was at school. My friend used to do stuff for the BBC in Bristol, and there was a guy who, a former teacher, who used to let a bunch of teenagers kind of put together a little radio show monthly, which would be sent out to schools in the area. I don't think, again, I'm not sure anyone ever heard that. Most of my history of radio, no one's ever really been listening. Well, even when I got to XFM with Ricky Gervais, no one was really listening until many years later. So I had a taste for radio, and I used to listen to it a lot at home, and I used to kind of, you know, I was a big fan of, you know, people like Chris Evans when they were on the radio, and Danny Baker. And what I always loved about radio was the fact that at its best, it was like you were just listening to your friends having a conversation. And certainly by the time I got to Warwick, and certainly by the time I got to London, that was always the objective, was to try and make it seem to the listener like you were just eavesdropping on a couple of friends just chewing the fat.
Yeah.
We managed to find the entry for your radio yearbook, and there's one line here that's confused us most of all, which suggests that you once suckled milk from a cow's udder. Is there anything to that, or was it just a...
What is this yearbook?
There's this whole thing saying the man behind the funniest show on W963, The Steve Show, and a few things you did, and then there's just one line which says, he once suckled milk from a cow's udder. Is there any truth to that, or has someone just...
I don't know what article you're reading, but the sucking milk from the udder was nothing to do... that was something that Ricky Gervais always used to accuse his friend Robin Ince of having done. And then I think he would occasionally just accuse different people of having sucked milk from udders. I think just to start rumours. But I don't remember that being a rumour when I was at university, unless it was and I just didn't know about it. It was what people said behind my back. There's that really tall, freakishly tall guy that suckles milk from udders. I don't know where exactly that article is. I don't even remember there being a yearbook.
Apparently so. But maybe someone's just tampered with something we're looking at instead. Yeah. It may not necessarily be as true as we've been led to believe.
I think that's the unfortunate nature of the internet and Wikipedia and all these things. It's just people can write anything. I'm not even sure anymore what the truth is, where I appeared. Maybe I did suckle milk from an udder.
Did you telephone the Library Bridge security post to ask if they'd seen a lost ball? Is that any more true?
That rings a bell.
Ah, there we go.
And I remember phoning Paramount Film Studios trying to get through to the actor George Takei, who plays Mr. Sulu. I remember that was a thing. I can't remember. I mean, it's so long ago. It's funny. I was being reminded of stuff just recently, actually, over the Christmas break by my dad. He remembers, like, listening to tapes, and he remembers stuff that we did more vividly than I did. I mean, we took it seriously. We did it once a week, you know, and we churned a lot of material out.
How far did you get with George Takei then? Actually, I'm quite curious on that one.
I couldn't get beyond the receptionist at Paramount.
Oh.
You know, as you can imagine, George Takei doesn't just live on the lot at Paramount. Yeah. I was a bit of a stab in the dark. Yeah. I guess at the time I was trying to be sort of irreverent. I was a big fan of Chris Morris. Not all of your listeners will necessarily be familiar with Chris Morris's radio stuff, but Chris Morris, who later did Brass Eye and lots of kind of satirical stuff on TV, at the time had a radio show that was very subversive and naughty, and he was always getting fired for being outrageous. So I think he was probably a big influence on me as well. I was always trying to do stuff like that. I mean, one of the most infamous things we did, which I am ashamed of, was we did a sort of spoof radio documentary called At Home with Fred and Rose West, which was, for your listeners who aren't familiar with Fred and Rose West, they're a fairly unsavory pair of serial killers. So yeah, that was unsavory. I kind of regret that looking back.
So once you obviously finished up at Warwick, you went on to XFM with Ricky. Is it how true is it the way you met him, that your name was, you know, the first, your CV, sorry, was the first on the pile?
I don't know if it literally was the first on the pile, but I must have. I mean, Ricky at that time was a fairly lazy man. And I mean, certainly I didn't get the sense that he had interviewed anyone else for the position, which I ultimately got, because he was sort of my boss. You know, he'd got hired by this radio station and immediately demanded an assistant, and by chance I had sent my CV in looking for work, and he saw it and called me up, and we sort of hit it off. So yeah, I certainly never felt like I was in competition with anyone else.
So you were there for 7 years at XFM. What's the difference between student radio and then when you actually go to a company in a national or even just London radio station? Is there a huge difference as the free reign you have? Or
you get paid.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Nice, yeah.
That's different. That's different. You get a handful more listeners. XFM was bizarre because the day that it launched, it was a new station, it was a brand new station, and the day that it launched was the day after Princess Diana had died. So, as you can imagine, there was a very mournful, solemn sense in the country, and you really couldn't play kind of up-tempo indie music, which was what the station was supposed to be about, and there were all kinds of songs that were banned because they might be offensive. I remember Airbag by Radiohead was banned because Diana died in a car crash.
Yeah.
And all sorts of things like that. And so the station launched, and it didn't really get any publicity or listeners because everyone was just very gloomy. And it took a while for that to sort of recover. And the difference with, I mean, student radio, you never had really any, I mean, you know, there was no one really listening, so there was no real censorship. I mean, we tried to censor ourselves and be professional, but we probably could have got away with anything. With real radio, you have to play by certain guidelines and certain rules, which we always had fun in trying to kind of get around, because some of them were so absurd. Like, for instance, you couldn't say cock, meaning penis, but you could say cock, meaning cockerel.
Yeah.
So we would say cock and then say we mean the bird.
Yeah, obviously, yeah.
Just, I mean, so juvenile. But for some reason, when there are rules in place, it does somehow make you feel more irreverent, you know, and more kind of dangerous.
Yeah.
You sort of need the rules in order to feel naughty.
So we obviously can't talk to you without mentioning The Office, and because it's such a successful show. When did that start to become a thing with you and Ricky? When did the first ideas come about for that?
Well, Ricky had a few observations about sort of office types, or I should say kind of boss types, that that he used to joke with me about when we were at the radio station. And I very quickly realized that we were probably going to get fired from the radio station. We didn't really have any purpose there. And no one was particularly enamoured of us. And so I thought, I'll jump ship. So I joined the BBC, and while at the BBC, I got the chance to do this training film, and I said to Ricky, well, why don't we sort of do something with those office observations? And that became this sort of 20-minute taster tape, I suppose, of what became The Office. It was Ricky as that character, and we went back to his old workplace and we filmed in his old office, and then before we knew it, it was getting handed around the BBC as a sort of underground tape of kind of, oh, you should see this, this is really good, and we gathered momentum from there, really, and off we went. And we sort of, even though one of my ambitions was to do a sitcom and be sort of like John Cleese or one of those people, I think we sort of lucked into that, really. It all happened much quicker than I imagined it would have done. Before we knew it, we were sort of making a pilot episode, and then we were doing the series, and off it went.
Just one little note that we found again, but obviously the way things have been going with various interviews, all the notes we found sometimes just aren't true. It says you did appear on Blockbusters. Did that have anything to do with the character in The Office being in Blockbusters? Was that your own...
Oh, it might have done, yes. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. Yes, I did. I was in Blockbusters. When I was still in sixth form, that same friend who had introduced me to the sort of radio stuff at the BBC when I was a teenager, he had been on Blockbusters, the quiz show, in its heyday in the 80s, and he told me it was the best fun ever, and that they'd all been sort of, they were basically, because it was always students who were the contestants, and he'd gone up to Manchester and they'd been in this hotel and they'd just run amok and they were going out and getting drunk and hooking up with each other. It was just the most fun ever. And so I got the chance to sort of, he and I, to audition for Blockbusters again, and I thought, this is going to be amazing, it's going to be this wild, debauched time where I might even win some money. And I went along to the auditions with him, thinking he's a Cambridge graduate, he's done it before, we're going to be the kings of the airwaves. And his sister drove us to the audition, and the producers went, oh my God, a sister and a brother, that's a great thing, we'll put them together on the show. And you, lanky freak guy who suckles milk from udders, you can go on your own. It was pitiful, and I went up to Manchester, and it turns out it was not a wild and rock and roll bunch of students, but by this point they had allowed anyone to join the quiz, and so there were sort of old ladies and like a biker dude and, you know, some sort of quaint married couples, and it was miserable, and I had a terrible time, and then I didn't answer any questions right, and the whole thing was just a humiliating and woeful experience, and I'd rather not talk about it.
Okay, we'll move on to another quiz show point. Did you know you were a pointless answer on Pointless?
I didn't know I was a pointless answer on Pointless. Mm. No, I suppose that's quite depressing, isn't it, if you're a pointless answer?
Well, it was the question, there were some pictures of celebrities in Halloween costumes, and yours from a certain year was a pointless answer. Can you guess which costume of yours it might be?
Was it the one where I was the Invisible Man?
No, unfortunately, I don't think they got a photo of you that year.
I don't know then.
It was the one from Alien with the chest burster.
Oh, okay, right,
I thought
right.
It was
right.
A great costume. I got it right.
So I was quite impressed with that costume, actually.
Yeah, I thought it was very good.
I made that myself, I should point out.
How did you do that?
It's too complicated, and again, I'm going to reuse that costume for years to come, so I can't give away the.
That's fair.
Fair enough.
That
yeah.
is fair. So obviously, I mean, The Office is this show that everybody knows, but it's not just here anymore, and the US Office is one of the most famous shows going as well. How have you found being in the UK and being in the US, because you seem to be split between the two near constantly now?
Well, because of the American version of The Office, I started spending more and more time there and more time in Los Angeles. And after a while, I had a good network of friends there. And I just, you know, for people that have never been to that town, it's a very strange place. When you first go there, it's a very lonely place, because unlike a major city like London or New York, where you can sort of wander around and just sort of bump into life, everyone in LA is in their car, so it's a much more isolating place. But once you get to understand it, it's got a nice pace of life, it's more chilled out, and it's obviously sunny all the time. And if you're a nerdy fan of movies and comedy and TV like I am, who wants to be in that business, you know, it's a whole town in which almost everyone there is doing that same job. And so it's sort of like being in this town where everyone shares your interests. And so I do like spending time there, and you know, it's fun to work there. But equally, I do love coming back here to England and sort of, you know, and being allergic to my flat and being reminded of what real life is like.
So you recently were on the stage in London in The Mentalist. How was that as an experience?
Well, I'd always wanted to do a play because I felt that I hadn't ever really earned my acting chops, and I should sort of do it to challenge myself and push myself. And then I did it, and the rehearsal period was fascinating. I learned a great deal, and they would make me play stupid theatre games where, you know, I'd have to pretend to be a monkey and the other guy would pretend to be a zookeeper. Why I had to be the monkey, I don't know. I've won three BAFTAs and two Golden Globes, but anyway, I was the monkey. But and I thought it all seemed silly, and actually it was very useful, and I understood why we were doing it. And then we built up to the opening night, and that was all great, and I was really enjoying it. And then once we were into the run of the play, I really struggled, because I realized that I didn't enjoy doing the same thing every night. I realized that one of the things I've liked about stand-up and writing and even acting on TV is that you kind of get to change things and experiment and play around, and that's the thing I enjoy. And that the problem with stage acting is you've just got to do the same thing every night, and you say the same words, and you say them in the same order, in the same place. And you do it 8 times a week if you have matinees, and it's really tough. And I know this sounds like champagne problems, you know, but honestly, it's just something about my DNA and the acting world did not gel. So shan't be rushing back to it if I'm truthful.
Fair enough.
One other strange experience, or not strange, rather, another experience you've had, you've been all over the place with the various ways you can act and write and that sort of thing. Portal 2, how was that for you as an experience doing a video game narration?
That was interesting. That was tough. That was very hard, because when you do a video game voiceover, you have to stand in a little sound booth, and obviously the game isn't made yet, so you just have to trust that they know what they're doing, and they tell you to shout down there, and so you just spend ages shouting at sort of imaginary video game players. And of course, with a video game, you have to record every possible option that the player could play. So it's not just like one straightforward plot. You have to do all these other versions, like if someone went down the wrong way or they tried a different approach to the game. So you're just in this booth for hours, days, just shouting, and it's, again, very hard work. But what was great about it was that I just didn't realize how popular that game was. And I have this entire fan base of people who don't know me from anything but that video game and just love it and play it all the time, and will send me kind of gifts and drawings and sort of fan letters about just that game. So it's nice to have sort of been able to tap into that. In fact, I was nominated for a couple of voiceover awards that year, and the person I often lost against was Mark Hamill, Skywalker. So I've actually been defeated by Luke Skywalker. Actually, and I beat him in one of them. I won, he didn't, so I am better than a Jedi.
Yeah. Speaking of games, can we now play a quick game with you?
Okay.
We've called it Stephen's Merchants.
Great.
And what we'll do is we'll give you a quick cryptic sentence that describes a merchant. So for an example, the first one is an oily fowl in American Derby. Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Say that again.
Oily fowl in American Derby. So American Derby, Kentucky Derby.
Yeah.
Oily fowl, fried chicken. And so we'll give you a little cryptic sentence, and you have to guess the merchant.
Wow, this is one of the most complicated games. I mean, let's be honest, it's not going to give Pointless a run for its money.
Well, we've spent weeks on this, so... So please at least just give it a go.
Guys.
First one's a bit of an older one. Mary had a pure record.
Mary had a pure record. Oh my God, this is my worst nightmare. I'm so hopeless at anything cryptic. I never go near crosswords. Well, I didn't score anything on Blockbusters. Say that one again.
Mary had a pure record. It's not a shop anymore.
Mary had a pure record. Mary had a pure record. A pure record. So is it a music shop?
Yeah, yes. Go along the record, yeah.
Mary was a... What does that supposed to mean? Mary was a...
Jesus' mother Mary was a...
There's a lot of Marys. Why would I automatically go to that Mary?
Mary your record?
Lamb, Mary the Little Lamb.
Yeah, you could... This is probably the toughest one. We probably gave you the toughest one to start with.
So Mary was what? The mother of Jesus? Mary was a virgin? Virgin
that's record. The one. Yes, there you go.
Yes, there we go. We got there in the end.
That's not even a cryptic clue. That's just an arbitrary bunch of words.
The next one is...
this one's a bit easier. Just simply spicy Indian dishes.
Just spicy Indian dishes. Just a takeaway? Just an Indian takeaway?
They sell more white goods and electronics.
Yeah. Curries.
Yeah, there we go.
Well, this is like the sort of quiz that Carl Pilkington would come up with. And that's not a compliment.
No.
We'll take it as such anyway. The one after this.
The one after this. The one after this. The one after this. So, the one after this. Tomorrow. Something tomorrow.
Oh, you nearly had it there.
Now.
Clothes. They sell clothes.
Clothes.
Well, say that again. What?
They sell clothes. The one after this.
The one after this. Next.
There we go.
Yes. And to finish off, you find the chickens living here.
You find the chickens living here?
Yeah.
Where do chickens live? In a. They live on a farm.
Yeah.
They live in a hut.
What's the hut called for chickens specifically?
What's it called specifically?
Yeah,
it's called the the what is it called?
A chicken.
Chicken run. A chicken coop.
Yes, the one. Yeah.
And break up coop into two syllables now.
Co-op.
Yes.
I mean, no one's getting that.
Yeah. In fairness, we did find those ones online. They were. we thought we'd give them a go, and you got them.
You did all right.
You got them.
With a bit of help. Yeah. Wow.
Thank you for playing Stephen Merchant.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think this is going to be a big hit show, guys.
We tried.
Banking on this making your fortune.
Yeah, I think possibly that was a one-off game there.
Yeah.
Plus, with no one else called Stephen Merchant that we're going to be interviewing, it wouldn't really work with that.
That's the other problem you're going to have. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh well. Thank you so much for talking to us, Stephen.
Of course, you're welcome, guys.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you for responding to us and coming on the show for us.
Of course, you're welcome.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Have a good day.
All the best.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.